Common Interest Ownership Act to get whatever materials they want, and that would be Senator Fakes and Senator Rohde, and we'll take that up any time that they wish to bring it up. Senator Josephson, we're asking to look in the Pacific Marine Insurance Company materials and report on it. Every member in their packet should have a letter from the Attorney General on this subject. We poked around in it last fall one time, and it's it may well be a serious matter. I think Beth says the packet should have that letter. I asked her to put it in. The first bill up today is consideration of Senator Sturzelewski's bill on liability of directors of corporations. Her staff has put together a new CS working with our staff, which deletes the supermajority needed for native corporations and adds cooperatives. And that particular CS is dated 2/9 and is designated number 1 so as to avoid confusion. There is a second CS if you want to consider a second one, an alternative, which would not give the native corporations a break, but we haven't distributed them yet. We've added this one for your consideration. It's based on testimony previously. And I think, again, the addition of cooperatives is pretty simple. Mr. Tellinghast, do you wish to testify on this bill one more time? The possibility. We have a committee substitute that hasn't been adopted, but I do have it just before you for consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John Tellinghast from Birch Horton Bittner representing Sea Alaska Corporation. Yesterday, we passed out to all the committee members a letter explaining that we thought there were a number of sound public policy reasons for allowing native corporations to limit liability on a majority vote. I guess what I prefer to do, rather than reiterate what's in there, and I'm sure you've all seen that it's in the record, is just ask if the chairman or any members of the committee have any questions.
Yeah, you wrote a very good letter.
Thank you, Chairman.
Have you seen that? Senator Fakes, was that made available?
Should have been if it was. Thank you.
Let me see. I got it. You betcha. Thank you, Senator. Yes, have you read it?
We'll take a few minutes of these here while we're just taking a look at.
You know, when this bill came in, it just handled profit making corporations, and then it has gained as we've gone along. But I think that this issue was raised by Sea Alaska. In Section 2, where they're talking about the normal structure of corporations, I think in Alaska we tend to have small corporations, relatively small in terms of stockholders. I suppose some of our banks would have been the ones with the largest number of stockholders, but also the banks, and this is true of most outside corporations or the big ones that might be coming here, have a majority of stock held either by, you know, proxy or so on, so that it's easy for the control. And I think that whenever they're, you know, either boards of directors tend to be self-perpetuating, it's easy to get amendments through. It is not the same kind of situation with the native corporations. There is a difference with the individual membership, and the fact that it would be very hard, I think, to get the full 2/3. So I think there are some differences.
Are there any questions over the letter or the appropriate? Senator Joseph and Senator Rohde, we just have the two conditions of amending in of the cooperatives, and in this particular suggested committee substitute before you, number 1, also includes the native corporations, and Senator Tellinghast, or Mr. Tellinghast, rather, is right here. Attorney General Tellinghast is right here to 21st member, whatever, to answer any questions on that amendment as part of the CS.
Just addressing the CS, Mr. Chairman, it's my understanding that the amendment added in cooperatives, and native corporations are covered as well.
Yes.
as general stock corporations in the state of Alaska.
Right. That's correct.
Okay.
Right. But Mr. Chairman,
there is a very good letter. If I can follow part of a rhetorical question. One of the problems is that incorporation in the state of Alaska is essentially a license to steal the way it is now. You have this a series of corporations that can be set up when it's done in Anchorage, and in the other cities where
people who incorporate, they'll accumulate debts and then just walk away. We see it on the records of the Department of Commerce, and I'm a little bit reluctant to, I understand some of the problems with larger corporations, but I'd like to deal with that problem, because a great many Alaskan businessmen and businesswomen get caught in that crunch, and it's been a suggested revision for our corporation law for a long time. It hasn't come about, and I would rather not make the matter. do you have any response to that?
Thankfully, it has nothing to do with the voting requirements for native corporations. I don't think native corporations are in that situation. I don't. The sponsor of the bill might speak to it, but it seemed to me that would be the best way to tackle that issue would be in the corporate code revisions themselves, perhaps with the capitalization requirements.
Or the liability requirements is the other way. So there is, so personal liability does flow for.
We got ourselves a Liechtenstein situation.
I'm afraid to, Mr. Chairman, the situation is someone will incorporate as Alaska produce sales go to the Matanuska Valley, buy a great deal of produce, some of it on credit from an unsuspecting farmer, and then not pay that unsuspecting, hardworking farmer.
Why are you interfering with my business activities?
Well, Mr. Chairman,
you're the hardworking farmer.
Mr. Chairman,
you have the floor.
Senator Rohde, we have the corporate bill. It's very large. I don't think it has someone in a sense leading the charge, or at least I haven't seen that activity. It's a very large bill. Are you saying that there's a discrete part of that that should be taken out and addressed? And if so, I think that, you know, certainly there are ways we could sponsor that and get it introduced. I don't know.
It's as Edward Abbey, the clerk, said, it's a delicate balance, because we have large corporations such as banks or other corporations where you want knowledgeable citizens to serve on the board, and knowledgeable and particularly wealthy citizens are reluctant to do that if they, particularly in banking, where they might have responsibility for errors or omissions. And on the other hand, you have the serial incorporation problem where many small businessmen and women are deprived of money that are right for theirs. I think that's the dilemma.
Senator Joseph, thank you very much.
Maybe I missed some of the discussion. What is the factual situation in Alaska regarding coverage? I mean, as I understand, Alaska is one of the few states that allows the corporation at its expense to buy E&O coverage for directors, and I infer that the reason for the bill is that the coverage is unavailable or too expensive. Can I get some data about that? Is that the case?
Mr. Chairman, could we have Mr. Kirkpatrick come up?
Yes, I would ask Willis to come up. As a matter of fact, you're on top of some of the problem, at least for banks. That is, they don't wish to buy liability. Coverage is terribly expensive.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Willis Kirkpatrick, Director of Banking Securities Corporation. Your question?
Is there a trend afoot in terms of the opportunity to secure E&O coverage for directors of banks and corporations?
With the example of the financial institutions, the errors and omissions and the fidelity insurance is picked up by the financial institution to cover the board of directors and other employees and officers. With corporations, there's a section under Title 10, Chapter 5, that addresses that, but I don't believe, and I would have to check, but I don't believe that it specifically provides for or denies the purchase of that type of liability insurance by the corporation. So my answer, I guess, is I don't know if that's addressed.
I think we allow the corporation to buy coverage. There's a reference to a statute that says we do. But does your office get complaints from the, you know, the XYZ furniture store that says that our director's coverage is going off, you know, like doctors are complaining about the malpractice coverage.
Okay.
Are you getting that kind
of... I understand.
Okay.
We get no complaints about the filing requirements under Title 10, with the exception of the reporting of shareholders and alien ownership. Those are the only complaints we ever get in filing under Title 10.
Mr. Joseph, I might presume to answer a bit of it. It's my experience in understanding that most of the small banks find it prohibitive to purchase any coverage for their directors, probably for their officers, various omissions. They're just not doing it.
Mr. Chairman, again, and I'm sure that Mr. Kirkpatrick may be able to speak to this. We had two corporations looking at coming to Alaska. They were seafood processors. They are doing business here. They were looking at, from a competitive point of view, frankly, and Washington State passed legislation similar to this last year. Delaware has passed it. And what we're looking at are the suits of members of the shareholders of the corporation against the board of directors. And what this does is to limit the liability against individual directors, but they still cannot, you know, have intentional misconduct, knowing violation of the law. They can't not manage the assets prudently, all of those things. So I think that it... and it also, of course, when we bring in the nonprofits and the others, it makes people feel freer about becoming a board of directors. And that's a complaint you often hear, that I know I served on a bank board, and I know three directors, very well-known businessmen, that frankly got off because of some issues that dealt with CFIRST. That was an example where they were held individually liable for their acts. And you know, I don't know whether there are other things that can be said on behalf of, but that's really the motivation of the law, and yet they still have to carry out all of the prudent responsibilities of the law.
I got off the board, too, and three years later the bank closed.
Yeah,
I just let this...
Mr. Kirkpatrick and then Mr. Tilling, you asked the senators.
Mr. Chairman, I look very favorably at the bill and its... and the committee substitute being considered. One of the things that we try to do in the administration of corporate law is that we at least want to be competitive with other states. It's very difficult to be competitive with Delaware because they were the genesis of allowing liberal corporate entities. But one of the things that we want to be careful not to do is fall obsolete. Anybody that wants to do business in Alaska can incorporate in any state in the union. And just by getting a certificate of authority as a foreign corporation can set their business up in Alaska. So one of the things that we want to do is at least offer the corporate entity advantages as much as we can in relationship to especially neighboring states. For that reason, if somebody wants to domicile a corporation in Alaska, it would be to Alaska's benefit to have a statute that would allow that domicile if they have problems with it. The reason that we don't get complaints, if somebody doesn't like our corporate law, they have 49 other states to choose from. They can incorporate, send us a certificate, you know, make an application for a certificate of authority, and they can set their business up in Alaska. So with that, this type of law has been in effect in Delaware now for, I think, about 2 or 3 years without any problems at all. It's more or less defined as an option the people forming the corporation as to how they want to limit officers' liability. And we see it as a move that would add a little strength and possibly a little modernization of the of Title X. I see no downside risk to it at all. As I say, if they don't like our law, they can incorporate in some other state. An example of that, we have a domestic corporation by the name of Alaska Airlines, and their operations are out of Seattle. We have a Delaware corporation whose only business is in Anchorage, and that's National Bank Corporation. So they have a choice of any statute that they want to operate under. Any of the 49 other states' corporate laws, as far as to give them an entity as a corporation, then just by application for a certificate of authority, they can put their, they can put their business any place they want it.
What about Senator Rohde's position on essentially something relating to Blue Sky?
The Alaska Code Revision Commission is considering whether or not officers and directors shouldn't have a liability for some of their action, and that is, I see it apart from this. If I remember that statute, or proposed statute, it would say that up to $25,000, the officers or the directors, officers and directors of a corporation, may have a liability to certain creditors. So this would be a limited liability to try and stem the idea of forming a corporation, run up some debts, then dissolve the corporation, form another corporation, run up some debts, dissolve that, and form another corporation, which has been an experience, I believe, in California and maybe a couple of other states. But I believe that's a little bit apart from what we have here.
Sure it is. It was just a comment.
Yeah.
So what you're saying, to be competitive, and then I'll quit, to be competitive with recent activities in states that do business in Alaska now, they're incorporating other states, to be competitive, you recommend this statutory change, not speaking to the concerns that Senator Rohde spoke to, which this doesn't alter or doesn't liberalize or make or affect. Yes, sir.
What are the advantages to domestic incorporation as opposed to a certificate of authority from the public policy?
That's a hard question.
Is it a matter of fees? Your fees?
Well, it's the difference between $100 and $200 a year.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator.
Just a comment, and Mr. Kirkpatrick might have others, but in the case of the two corporations I talked to, happened to feel in this case, the fishing industry, that there was not good understanding of the, very frankly, the Anchorage business community in terms of fishing and opportunities and relationships. They wanted to be a part of the business community of Alaska and to be seen as an Alaskan corporation. And there were no other reasons other than that they wanted, in fact, to be seen a part of it where they are by their investment and so on. That's where their business is. And we've been trying for a long time, I think, to see, instead of so many things going out to Washington State corporations, to attract those corporations to our state. It's just that simple thing is they become Alaskan. And we've heard lots of people say in Alaska Airlines, well, they're not really Alaskans because they're not an Alaskan corporation anymore.
Mr. Chairman, if I may respond to that, that's true. That's an important part to some people's identity and to where they're doing business. Alaska Airlines formed a holding company, and that holding company was formed in Delaware so that they, for other operating subsidiaries. There was a question by my staff, my corporation staff, as to whether they would be moving the domicile of the Alaska Airline domestic corporation, and who they were, and I don't know who they were talking to, whether it was their counsel or who, but they felt that it was important to leave that domicile in Alaska because it gave them the entity as being Alaska. So that that's important to a lot of businessmen's how they want to portray themselves in their particular market.
Yeah, Mr. Tongue,
yes. Two quick points. One, in terms of the advantage of forming a separate Alaska corporation, a lot of states have separate corporate reporting for their corporate income taxes. So that if a new entity wants to do business in Alaska, if it can open up a separate subsidiary in Alaska, then it will in many states avoid paying taxes on that income. If, on the other hand, it can only do that at the price of submitting to an unacceptable corporate code or a corporate code that's behind the times, then it's facing a difficult choice that may be a disincentive for them to come up to Alaska at all. The second point, I want to reassure Senator Rohde that this bill doesn't allow the limitation of any liability with respect to a director's liability to a third party or a creditor. The only limitation that it allows is a limitation as between the director and his own shareholders. It in essence allows the shareholders and the directors to serve them to enter into an agreement that in certain circumstances the director's liability to the shareholders will be limited for simple negligence.
Further questions, please, gentlemen? Is there a proposed motion to adopt a substitute? We also have a substitute. You have
Mr. Support? Chairman, I move that we adopt number one committee substitute for Senate Bill 343, Judiciary, dated 2988.
Objection, so ordered. Number one is before us, committee substitute for Senate Bill 343. Is there any testimony or comment about this bill?
Mr. Chairman, are you ready? I'll move it out.
Yes, I think there. We're prepared, sir.
Mr. Chairman, I would move a committee substitute for Senate Bill 343, Judiciary, out of the committee with individual recommendation.
Without objection, that is so ordered. The next item before us is Senator Halford here, or his staff. The second bill we take up is Senator Halford's bill, Senate Bill 252, attempted murder in the first degree. There was a prior commitment of the author, or in the person that introduced the legislation, but Teresa Mazur is available for questions. She'd also prefer district attorney or persons from the AG's office to appear. Thank you. Give me just a moment. Senate Bill 352 is before us, and you may identify yourself if you wish to testify.
Yes, my name is Teresa Mazur. I'm here representing Senator Rick Halford, who has a prior commitment and couldn't come before you today. The bill that we're addressing, the Senate Bill 352, which would raise the crime of attempted murder in the first degree to an unclassified felony from a Class A felony, where it currently is, and adjust also the sentencing structure and the fine imposable for the crime. The reason the senator brought this bill in for introduction was because of some law enforcement individuals approached him during the interview to make him aware of the fact that the crime of attempted murder in the first degree, which carries along with it a deliberate, intentional act intending to commit the murder. The only reason that a person didn't actually succeed would maybe be that a bullet hit a medallion and deflected off, or an act of God, or some reason that the individual didn't die was the only thing that kept it from being murder. And the crime carried with it a penalty that, since it was only an attempt, the maximum imposable fine was 20 years, which, given the presumptive sentencing for Class A felonies, would bring it down to a presumptive term of 5 years, or the maximum would be 7 years. With good time that we have here in Alaska, that would bring it down to 3.5 or 5 years. So an individual who committed a deliberate, intentional act to commit the murder of another individual could essentially, if it was their first time, their first attempt at murder, could get off within 3.5 to 5 years. And the senator felt that this was terrible and introduced this bill to correct the problems.
Other questions of the party before us? Beth, do you have any questions or errors in this?
Teresa, I had one question, but I think maybe we should wait for Stephanie, and that was just if you thought about what the situation is in making an attempt the same penalty as a crime that's already been committed, fully committed. My only concern with that, and unfortunately it's from previous experience with people who have attempted crimes, is that a lot of criminals do really know what the sentences are. And my concern is, if we make an attempt the same penalty as a fully committed crime, are we creating possibly a situation where the person will go ahead and, for instance, murder the person, rather than realizing that the penalty is slightly different for, well, it is different, radically different, but it's different for an attempt than it is for a fully committed crime. I'm a little rusty on this, and I just thought about it coming over today, so I may be wrong. It may be that the attempt will still remain, I can't quite remember that, if the attempt will still remain a lesser sentence than the fully committed crime, but that's my only concern, is that those two things not be the same.
Okay, at this point in time, this particular bill states that murder in the first degree has a definite term of imprisonment of 20 to 99 years. Now, this bill would say that attempted murder in the first degree, meaning you have all of the things that go along with first degree murder, be sentenced, the individual would be sentenced to a definite term of 20 to 50 years. So it does have a difference only in terms of the maximum. However, there had been some, this is not set in stone, there had been some discussion of 15 years to 50 years. There's, you know, that is something that the senator would be certainly amenable to if there wanted some sort of change to that, bringing it down to 15 or something. But he did certainly feel that the presumptive sentencing of Class A felonies was just not enough.
If I could ask one other question, then I guess what we're doing is we're creating another sort of subsection of unclassified felonies for the attempt. Okay, thank you. That's all I want, a clarification on.
Representative Hanley wishes to testify on this. Please come forward. You may stay at the table if you'd like.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Representative Alice Hanley from District 9 in Anchorage. I was also approached and perhaps experienced or told about the frustration perhaps with the present statute. I think one of the cases that was brought to my attention was the case of the airline pilot, Robert File. Had he not died, he would have been a paraplegic, and it was very frustrating to recognize that probably the person guilty of that attempted murder would be faced with a maximum penalty of 20 years. Something that was of interest to me as we began looking into this, there was legislation introduced in the last session by Governor Sheffield, also to increase the penalty for attempted murder in the first degree. And I think what has also been brought to our attention is something the committee might want to address, is solicitation should probably also be included. Someone who's paid to murder someone, that solicitation in the first degree should probably be included in this. In the Senate panel. So I think one of the things that was interesting to me, one of the things that we thought was also an example of attempted murder was the story of the man who dropped a baby on her head and then put her in a bathtub, and that the baby lived and apparently is a vegetable now, blind and deaf and retarded. And that man has been sentenced, and I was under the impression that he had been sentenced for attempted murder, but in talking with the prosecuting attorney in that situation, he said he was not. It might be difficult to prove, and he said there was no reason to try to prove that this man had attempted to murder the child because the penalty for assault in the first degree is the same. So there was no reason really to try to prove that he had attempted to murder. I don't know if dropping a baby from 2 feet on his head, a year-old baby, is attempted murder, but the fact that assault in the first degree carried with it the same penalty as attempted murder, it was easy to prove assault, so this man was charged with two charges of assault in the first degree. So I think there's a concern that perhaps the statute for attempted murder and doing the new criminal code somehow fell between the cracks, and I think as Teresa mentioned, My bill is identical. There was nothing, you know, we've tried to get some consensus of opinion. I think many people think it should be a definite sentence rather than presumptive, but whether it be 15, I think we've heard everything from 15 to 99 to 20 to 50 to all kinds of varieties, and it doesn't seem to be a consensus. And so I think that, as Teresa mentioned, is we're certainly open to debate by the committee or willing to have that debated.
Any questions, Representative Hanlon? Are there others here that wish to testify on this? Ticker bill?
Yes. If I might, I think that we have problems with prior commitments in other committees, because I know Ms. Horetsky and the Attorney General's office also, we have asked just for input from the Public Defender Agency and the Office of Public Advocacy. So
we'll bring this bill up. It's a very serious piece of legislation. It involves some definite statutory changes that need to be definitely decided. I think that we'll hold this bill at this time until there's further testimony. We'll invite Senator Helford and AG's office and others to testify. I don't think it's technically particularly difficult to modify if a decision's made. And there's another bill before us at this time. A bill by Senator Fisher, if he has staff and others that wish to testify. Is the committee willing to wait 5 minutes? We'll recess for approximately 5 minutes. Bill 331 by Senator Fisher, and I believe the author is here as the opponent. However you wish to handle this with testimony, this bill would make a Class A misdemeanor to use and possess, manufacture, deliver, advertise drug paraphernalia. Paraphernalia would be subject to seizure by the police upon issuance of court order. Would be forfeited to the state upon conviction of a defendant or upon judgment of a court in a civil proceeding. The bill also lists the type of paraphernalia. Apparently, the Department of Health and Social Services supports the intent, but prefers the enforcement provisions of the law be examined by the Department of Public Safety and Law. That's the response we have. Senator Fisher, do you wish to speak to the bill? Please. Thank you for appearing. We know you're busy too.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. I'm glad this morning's over. What we've done is we've taken, and I think we just passed out, a Model Drug Paraphernalia Act that was drafted by the Drug Enforcement Administration of the U.S. Department of Justice. We took this particular act over to legal, and we said, draft a bill based on this particular form draft that we had, and that's the way the bill appears before you now. Now, if there are any legal situations that are somewhat different, I quite frankly can't tell you. The question always comes up as to whether or not this thing, if it goes to court, whether it's going to be upheld or whatever, and by 1980, using this model, 8 federal district courts have upheld model drug paraphernalia laws. And some of the states that they're talking about, Maryland, Delaware, New Jersey, have had challenges also and upheld, and I assume that was in our Supreme Court. So it's not something that's brand new. It's been around for a while. What I would like to do, though, is just briefly, we do have a lady here, Bobby Traney from Juneau, that maybe could just show the committee some of the kinds of things we are talking about. You know, too often people think we're talking about going out to Senator Tortola's area and closing down the farmers, and quite frankly, if they had a tractor that was mowing down, if it was mowing down marijuana, yeah, we think the tractor would be confiscated. But maybe Bobby, if you can just, if it's okay with the committee, just show them some of the kind of things we are talking about that we want to address to again the war on drugs.
If any person wants to assist, you may come forward. By here,
this isn't the bag lady.
He calls me Grandma when I bring my picnic basket.
Senator Fox and I know all about it.
Oh, do you want me to sit there?
Go anywhere.
Thank you.
I saw you as a co-sponsor on this bill.
Fisher's the only one listed.
I see that, but I remember you standing up. Yes?
Please do. Please proceed. And identify yourself, if you will.
I'm Bobby Traney. I'm a member of Alaskans for Drug-Free Youth, a member of Juneau's Safe Homes, which is a drug and alcohol prevention parent committee, licensed and registered drug and alcohol counselor of the state of Alaska, and a parent of two teenagers. Some of this paraphernalia is home grown, but some of it is commercial paraphernalia. And I had written testimony, but I don't think it's real appropriate to give you that today. But if you have questions, I'll try to answer it. Mostly what we're talking about is stuff like this that can be ordered commercially through many, many companies that sell in many towns and many communities. Many cities have ordinances against drug paraphernalia, but Alaska does not have any kind of a law which keeps it from being mailed in on a mail order kind of basis. And the main magazine that allows kids to get hold of drug paraphernalia is High Times, which also is considered to be part of a pro-drug kind of culture. And if you want, I'll pass this around. You can take a look in the back. Not only can kids get look-alike drugs and other kinds of things and all kinds of sex aids and things, they can get drug paraphernalia through High Times or through mail order numbers. This is an example. This is called a Bayou Blaster, and this is the official Mardi Gras Mambo machine made in New Orleans, and this is for smoking marijuana. And this is confiscated, so it does smell like marijuana. It's the troopers have given it to me to use. This is a tiny little one that you can order. And we have all kinds of stuff that comes. There are all kinds of games, like this is the intoxicating new card game Grass, which would be found more often at a paraphernalia shop than just a regular game shop. This tells you how to wheel and deal and learn how to get high. And it's a new card game that you buy and sell large quantities of very desirable weed. And while playing this game, you face government harassment, jail terms, fines, and cutthroat competition. As a vicarious dealer, you can make a fortune or watch it go up in smoke. Watch your smoke go up in smoke. So this is a card game that you might find. Some of the things that you find in paraphernalia shops are stash cans that are designed to look like pop cans or beer cans or hairspray cans for kids so they can hide their drugs from their folks so that when you go through their room, you can, you know, you figure, it's pop, they're okay, you know, it's all right. And then things that are sold in paraphernalia shops as well as gas and goes and places where you can buy beer are labels to go around them so that when you're drinking and driving, the police won't know that you're really consuming alcohol rather than pop. So this is something that kids would find either by mail order or at establishments that are allowed to sell paraphernalia. This book really is not paraphernalia, but it's something that you find in lots of places, but it's the Child's Garden of Grass, and it's your grass grower's Bible on how to do all the information that you want about grass, and that's something that really doesn't come under paraphernalia, but could be considered that. This is a power hitter for smoking pot, shaped like a football for kids. There are frisbees and all kinds of kid toys that are actually drug paraphernalia disguised as toys for kids. Along with this, other kinds of, this is called Big Hit, another power hitter pot. You'll find scales to weigh and measure different kinds of drugs in paraphernalia shops. You find all kinds of pot pipes, commercial pipes that are available for smoking, all kinds, things like that. You always find stuff like this, roach clips, another kind. Actually, I think I have another kind of roach clip in here too. Nope. Anyway, those are the kinds of paraphernalia. Oh, here's a couple more things that you can find, and then I'll be done. This is a wooden pipe. Rolling papers are always around when kids are smoking pot. And cocaine cutting kits that you're going to find with all the things available, you know, for cutting cocaine. Scales that are used can be found other places, but most prevalent they'll be found in a drug paraphernalia shop. Sifters to sift cocaine, these could be found in spice shops, but you're going to find them often. Linda Adams in Ketchikan just found a little teeny tiny vacuum cleaner that you use to vacuum up your coke tracks so that you don't get any residue. It's this little teeny, teeny, teeny tiny little vacuum cleaner, and so you don't accidentally leave anything behind. Certainly, we have lots of things happening, but our main emphasis is what messages are the kids getting, and I think something that's real appalling is this children's Christmas stocking that's filled with cocaine cutting material. It has the mirror and the razor blade and a coke spoon and a little coke spoon for a necklace for kids to wear. And, you know, this is the kind of stuff you're going to find in a drug paraphernalia shop. In Alaska, they get creative sometimes and make their own kind of bonus and things. And kids are always going to make paraphernalia out of anything they can find in a plumbing shop. But certainly, the message is, if we care about drugs, we would want to consider passing this legislation and stopping our kids from having the tools that encourage them to use drugs.
Other questions? You have the floor.
Is High Time sold in drugstores or in magazines? Is it regular available in the newsstand?
There, a lot of parent groups have put pressure on communities and stores to not sell them. They're difficult to get a hold of. You can get it by subscription. And you can get, if it's sold in Juneau now, I'm not aware of where it is. At one time it was sold in several places in Juneau. The one paraphernalia shop that was here in Juneau that was in business was closed down, and so kids don't have a ready access in Juneau. But I found that particular issue, which has, interesting enough, the testimony from Senate Bill 32 from our House floor last year is included in High Times magazine. That's a copy from Washington, D.C. I just happened to find on the news.
Other questions or witness? Does the Attorney General's office wish to testify on this legislation?
Thank you.
Please come forward. Senator Fisher, you can join us if you'd like. Here's a seat here if you'd like.
Thank you.
You just identify yourself for the record. We are transcribed.
Thank you. My name is Stephanie Joannides. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law. I was requested to appear today to comment on the committee substitute for Senate Bill 331. I have not had a chance to do much research in the area of the constitutionality of the bill. In reviewing some old files, I have found a number of cases where the Model Act was found constitutional, and I've also found a number of cases cited where the Sixth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals has found municipal ordinances that have been patterned after the Model Act to be unconstitutional. So I would suggest to the committee that perhaps some research be done in that area to determine whether, in fact, the bill as it's drafted would pass constitutional muster. Particularly as to the bill as it's drafted now, assuming it is constitutional, I'll just have a few comments on the drafting. The first two or three sections that set out the crimes, particularly use and possession of drug paraphernalia.
The Senator Fisher's staff, Senator Fisher's staff,
not working on this particular bill.
Right. Okay. I was just thinking they might take notes from this. Okay. Well, we're doing technical work, which is correct, but we're also having to work on a whole lot of other bills that other committees make our staff do for ourselves. But I think that some staff would be reasonable.
Mr. Chairman, what we could do if the Attorney General's office has some opinions or has some suggestions for language change, we don't have any.
You will inquire, will you?
Yes, we can.
Okay, we'll both do so, but I just want to be sure. Thank you. Please proceed. Excuse me. I just thought maybe he had a staff out here in the group that wished to sit down and take notes. Thank you.
Specifically, the first three statutes that are set out on page one and the top of page two of the bill, I would suggest that the penalty provision that's located on page three, lines 11 to 17, be incorporated in each statute. That would follow the format of the other criminal statutes. Subsection B of the penalty provision found on page 2 increases the penalty to a Class C felony if a person who's over 18 sells to somebody who's under 18 and there's at least a 3-year difference. That kind of consideration can be done in two ways. It can either be considered an element of the offense. So in other words, the DA would have to go into court and prove in court that, in fact, the defendant sold to somebody who is less than 3 years of age than the defendant. Or it can be drafted to be a sentencing provision. So in other words, in the applicable statute would say at sentence, there is an argument that can be made because it's provided for by statute that if a defendant reasonably mistakes the age of his or her victim, then that is a defense. And perhaps the committee might want to consider that's an affirmative defense that the defendant has to raise. The committee might want to consider whether that area should be addressed in the bill.
Senator?
Yes, yeah, Mr. Chairman. So what section 1174050 on page 3 says is that there are two classes of penalties. It's a Class A misdemeanor for everybody unless it's somebody over 18 who sells to somebody 3 years younger.
Right, under 18 and who's 3 years younger.
So if they're 19 and they sell to a 16-year-old, this it's a Class C felony.
Right, if the numbers work out and it's at least 3 years. Sometimes it has to go down to 15.
But if it's a 19-year-old and they sell to a 17-year-old, that's a Class A misdemeanor.
That's correct. This language is patterned after language in other statutes. For example, in the sexual abuse of a minor statutes, this language is also there.
It's a 3-year provision?
Yes, under certain of the statutes.
Okay, but if you're 21, will it become a Class C felony if you sell to somebody, 18?
Under 18. I believe the
It's got to be under 18. So,
under
18. All right, so it's just that little band there.
Right.
Okay. Plus or minus 3 years. Got it.
Yeah, on page 2, AS 1171040, this statute sets out a number of factors that the court must consider. On line 5, it says a court or other authority shall consider, in addition to all, et cetera, et cetera. A review of these factors suggests that these factors attempt to change the rules of evidence. And if they are to do so, then the rule of evidence that is going to be changed needs to be incorporated in the bill. For example, subsection 2 says prior convictions, if any, of an owner or of a person in control of the object under state or federal law relating to a controlled substance. So under Evidence Rule 404B, if you're seeking to make a change in that area, we have to address it directly. Subsection 1 also, an argument could be made that that is attempting to change the hearsay rule and possibly might raise some Miranda concerns also. So that area also, or that subsection should also be looked at. The rest also suggests that possibly this statute might be affecting the general evidence rules relating to relevancy, because the court, in admitting certain evidence, considers whether it's relevant or not anyway. So this statute appears to require the court to consider certain evidence, whether the court, under the evidence rule, would find it's relevant or not.
Sure.
Moving on to page 3, the areas that deal with forfeitures, I would suggest to the committee that under the present law, drug paraphernalia can already be forfeited, that this provision really is unnecessary. If the committee wished to leave it in the bill, I haven't had an opportunity to check if it tracks the forfeiture laws. It's already in the books. If it doesn't, it probably should. But again, I'm not sure that it's even necessary. Lastly, as to comments that pertain directly to the bill, on page 7, which has the definition of drug paraphernalia and paraphernalia, there have been cases that have found the language equipment is used or intended for use is unconstitutional. And many of those statutes have crossed out the intended for use but left in the use. I provided Senator Fisher's office with some of that information. My last few comments deal with just some general legal concerns. It would appear that for these statutes to work, that we would have to charge in separate counts a defendant for each act of possession or delivery of paraphernalia. So, if, for example, if somebody had a razor blade and then had a straw and had other things, we would have to charge them separately. Then, as in many other cases, we might deal with joinder problems, where the court would find that it's prejudicial to consider all of those factors and would sever all the counts. So perhaps some thought into the area of joinder is appropriate in this bill. Unless there's any other questions, I don't have any other comments.
My suggestion is that perhaps an official want to get this bill drafter, get them in contact with the concerns that you have voiced, perhaps yourself by it, even with, we need that assistance, and go over a preliminary redraft. Probably we've got more questions now than answers for technical details and appropriate area of inclusion of certain of these paragraphs, chapters. Is there any question by Senator Fisher at this point?
No, I think the Chairman's suggestion is a good one. Being a layman is kind of frustrating because you assume when you get a bill back it's going to be in legal terms, you know?
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman.
I well understand it. I've got a bill I have introduced and didn't pay attention to. I'm speaking of moose, and the word caribou appears consistently, so, you know. Excuse me. Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, if I might just make one suggestion, I believe the first thing that would have to be determined is the constitutionality of the bill as it is, and some research would have to be done in that area before we actually spend time redrafting.
Right. Are you willing to check that out from your standpoint? We'll ask Beth to check it out, and we'll use Tam Cook and so on the constitutionality of the president.
Okay, in all fairness, for me to get to it, we're talking 3 to 4 weeks since we've had a reorganization. I'm the only person for the Department of Law that tracks every criminal bill, both in the House and Senate.
You can give suggestions or go if it becomes necessary.
I'm more than happy to speak to people about areas that they might want to focus their research.
I'd love to comment on the 100-day sessions, you know, weekends and all, or a session about 80 days, and you need 250% cooperation of the administrative branch in order to get out of here, you know, and do anything in tune with the checks and balances that we're supposed to be and are required. I have great sympathy for your problem. We have one too. Well, we'll deal with that frustration the best we can.
I guess we know how the administration feels about criminal bills.
Well, Bresky's in charge of these things, you know. He's got this whole area.
Thank you.
We'll take back up the murder bill next time with the authors, and I hope that the Attorney General's office will wish to testify.
The murder bill.
Attempted murder
yes.
bill.
Could you get a constitutional bill, please?
This is good. We appreciate Hess's appearance. Jay, we'll just
yes.
do it.